Thank you very much, Alessia, and thank you very much to the organizers in general for the invitation. I'm really glad to be here. So, okay, yes, today indeed I'm going to discuss a recent paper that we wrote with Kirill Krasnov. And if you want to have a look, it's here you have the archive number, and it's also been accepted very recently in classical and quantum gravity. So, yes, I want to, in this paper, we discuss some recent developments on our understanding of a specific class of modified gravity theories. And these modified gravity theories are very peculiar in that they share the exact same number of degrees of freedom as GR. So this is, of course, something remarkable. The problem is that although we know how to define them in the case of Euclidean or split signature, it's really hard to do so in the case of Lorentzian signature, which is the subject of this talk. And as the title suggests, this will have to do with complex formulations and reality conditions in order to obtain real Lorentzian gravity theories. Okay, so let's go. This is the outline of my talk. I will start by first giving a very quick description of complexified GR. I'm going to discuss in this context how, with different reality conditions, one can obtain real GR in different signatures. Then I'm going to move on to describe these deformed theories, these modified theories, and in particular the problem that one has then with Lorentzian signature real theories. In order to be able to have some explicit expressions and go till the end of the argumentation, I will have to restrict my attention to a subclass of these theories. Then I'm going to compute the geometrodynamics of these theories. These equations are essentially the novel and main aspect of this work. And the reason why these equations are important to have at hand is because they make explicit, or they make manifest, the problem with the imposition of the reality conditions. So at the end, I'm going to discuss this obstruction to reality, and not only in the case of the subclass of theories, but we will see that we will have some hints to get a taste of the general modified theory. And at the end, I will wrap everything up with a few takeaway messages. Super. So this is the starting point. This is the Plebansky action for the complex rotation group. So this, as you can see here, dates back to the 70s. So this is essentially a gauge theory in BF form. You have here the curvature two forms for the connection one forms. You have the B field two forms and two auxiliary fields, this psi ij and phi. So psi will impose some relation between B and phi. And here you see that phi essentially imposes a constraint on psi. So what do we have here? Here we have lambda, it's a constant. It's essentially the cosmological constant. And this mu ij is an internal metric. So in this complex context, you can just think of it as delta ij. And so this is the trace here. So essentially phi says that psi has a constant trace. So that is the Plebansky action, and it's a complex action. All the fields here are complex valued. So if we want to have a real theory out of it, we have to impose some reality conditions. And the simplest thing one can think of is simply, well, turn all the fields into real valued fields. So what happens when we do that, if we pick real fields, then one can see that the equation of motion of psi imposes a condition on B and phi, and there is a simple solution to that equation, is that B can be expressed in terms of some Fierbein. This is how the Fierbein, how the geometry emerges in this context. Here you have the time component and the space component. You have this nice combination, and phi is then just the volume four form. So what happens now with this? We can plug it back inside the action, and what we obtain is just the Palatini-Holst action with real fields. So this is real GR. And now, of course, the signature depends on what this mu is going to be here. If one picks mu to be delta ij, then the gauge group is just SO3. This is the self-dual component of SO4, so this is Euclidean GR. If, on the other hand, one chooses the only other option, which is a Minkowski internal metric, then this is SO12. It's the self-dual component of SO22, and therefore this is split signature GR. So here we already see that this, the simplest option of just making the fields real, well, leads to only these two possibilities, and in particular, not the physically relevant possibility of the SO13 group, right? So why is that? This is, of course, just pure simple group theory facts. The SO13 algebra is a complex algebra, and the self-dual part is also complex, the anti-self-dual being the complex conjugate. So in the Lorentzian case, we cannot just put simple reality conditions like that. We need complex fields. We need to keep working with these complex fields and impose nonlinear reality conditions. So this is less trivial, right? And in the case of GR, it turns out that these reality conditions are just the ones I wrote down here. And it's important to notice that these are 10 real conditions, right? This is a real number here. And here, this is a Hermitian matrix, 3x3. So this is 9 real numbers. And how can we understand these intuitively? Well, we can understand this by the fact that they correspond to making the underlying metric of the theory real, right? These are 10 conditions, 10 constraints on the metric. And what is this metric that we don't see so explicitly until now? Well, it can be built this way, and it was first built by Urbanke. So it is proportional to this combination of the B field. And then the proportionality factor is fixed by requiring that the volume form is this combination, right? So essentially what you see here, I mean, it's not trivial to see the relation, but essentially these equations say that this metric is real, okay? And also at the end, one can show that this metric is real and Lorentzian. Very good. So now that we have found how to impose these constraints in the case of the Lorentzian signature, we can again use the equation of motion of psi, find the solution for B, which this time also has a fear bind, so real fear bind, but it's a complex combination, right? This is real and this is pure imaginary. Phi is again the volume 4 form, and if we plug this back inside the action, we obtain the Lorentzian Palatini-Holst action, so this is a real Lorentzian GR. Very good, so this sets the context for what I'm about to discuss now. So now what we want to do is to generalize these theories, right? To deform them. And this is very easily done. It's in this form. So this is the original action that I wrote before, the Plebansky action. And the generalization we will consider is just to replace this function here of psi, which is set to 0 by phi. Well, we just replace it with a generic function of psi, right? That I'm going to call h of psi, and psi is a matrix, remember. So the first time this, the first peak at this new window was discovered in Capovilla, Dell, and Jacobson in this seminal paper, but they only consider one parameter, extension of GR. The full family was discovered by Bengtson and later rediscovered through different routes by Krasnov. And of course, as I already said, what's really amazing about these theories is that they have the same degree of freedom count as GR. Right. So, but as complex GR, we're still in the complex context. So these are theories of a massless spin to complex reality. So of course, this is remarkable because there is this usual mantra of the uniqueness of GR that comes with assumption, of course. And what else can we say about these theories? Well, one way of looking at them, which I find to be very intuitive and helpful to understand them, to understand what I'm about to say later, is to interpret them as a generalization of this internal metric here, mu. So in this, if you take again the equation of motion of psi here, you vary with respect to psi, what you obtain is this equation. And actually here you obtain this Hij matrix, which is just a variation of H with respect to its argument. In the case of GR, because this function is linear in psi, what we obtain is that this is just the internal metric, the metric of the group. Okay, so in the case of SO3, it's just delta ij. But here you see that this is more general. This is now a general function, matrix function of the psi matrix. So one way of understanding these theories is of, you know, generalizing the internal metric to a dynamical metric. Of course, this is still the same gauge group, but on top of the fixed metric related to the group, we also have this dynamical internal metric. And as we will see, this will really act as an internal metric, right? Good. So before I move on, I also want you to have a look at the purest way of looking at these theories. I mean, it's just aesthetics here, but you can indeed integrate out all the fields except for the curvature. So B, Psi, and Phi. And what you obtain, well, you see that these theories take this very simple form. So this generic action F of this matrix is related to this generic function, it's related to the choice of this H function here. And you see then that this is a very natural class of theories, right? And also for the sake of curiosity, the way GR looks in this context, well, it's this function here. So it's a bit awkward because you have to take a square root of some 3x3 matrix, then trace and square, but this is the face of GR in this context. Very good. So now that we have seen this possible generalization of GR in the complex case, then let's see what are some important facts, some important remarks one can say about them. So first of all, again, they avoid the uniqueness theorems, and this is done through chirality, as you can see if you want to in this paper here. Another interesting fact is that, again, if we just take all the fields to be real, then we obtain completely okay Euclidean and split signature theories. So this works pretty fine for them. So there is a question. Yes, please.
Hello, it's me. Yeah, yes. Can you say more about how it avoids uniqueness theorems? Because usually there's different proofs, which are mostly on-shell proofs about the amplitudes. So
exactly.
So, is it clear that this leads to different amplitudes, or where's the difference?
So my understanding, which is limited in that direction, is that, so I would refer you to this paper here by Kirill, but my understanding is really what you said about the amplitudes, right? So there is one way, one representation that you can choose for the graviton, which, and then you can see that it's unique, GR is unique. And then if you choose another representation, which is chiral, then you see that actually there is a full window of deformations. So, and all these other theories are chiral. So I cannot say much more about it because I'm really not an expert about it, but maybe Kirill can answer in two sentences that are much more relevant.
Try to answer quickly. So yeah, indeed that four amplitude case, there is a new amplitude that these deformations give, but it's a chiral amplitude. So these deformations add the 4 plus amplitude becomes non-zero, but the 4 minus becomes remains zero. So it's a chiral modification. But amplitudes do change, but they change in a way that is incompatible with unitarity in the Lorentzian signature. So even from looking at amplitudes, you see that these things cannot be Lorentzian.
Okay. Thank you.
Super. Thank you, Kirill. okay, very well. So as I said, if you just take the fields to be real, then you obtain, again, Euclidean and split signature theories that are different from GR. So that's interesting in this context. And also one other point that is worth mentioning is that these are UV modifications of GR, like in contrast to typically what one finds in cosmology, where one wants to change the infrared. Here you really change the interactions, right? And this point also leads to a very interesting question, which is whether this huge family, right? We have a free function, so it's an infinite parameter family of theories, whether this family is closed under the renormalization flow, right? So if you're interested, there is also some literature about this. But of course, the question of interest in this talk is what happens with the Lorentzian signature theories, right? So we know how to obtain them in the case of GR, but is it possible, first of all, and if so, how to do so for the deformed theories? This would, of course, be huge, right? Because if it were possible, it would mean that there's a full zoology of theories to explore that are not GR and could actually be physically relevant. Okay, so since the Lorentzian signature is the problem, from now on we focus on the Lorentzian case, and this is going to be the action. And I just wanted to show you here that typically it's much more convenient to just redefine some fields in order to make an imaginary unit pop up here. So okay, now this is our action, and we're going to see what to do with how to put reality conditions on it. So as a guiding possibility, let's look at the case of GR. Okay, I remind you here, these are the reality conditions for GR. And why should one take this as a starting point? Well, these deformed theories are continuous deformations of the GR action. So one would think that the potentially consistent reality conditions would also be deformations of the ones of GR. In any case, we have to look at the most general reality conditions in order not to miss any possible theory. So this is GR. So let's see how we can generalize each of these two constraints, right? So we have a scalar one and a tensor one. So we start with the former. And the generalization of this, well, would look something like that, right? Here we have just the trace of this BI BJ matrix, and we just make it pure imaginary. So the generalization would be some generic function of this matrix and then made pure imaginary. Now, of course, this function here would depend on this H function in the action. But the problem is that this is not really a new direction in theory space. I mean, as we show in our paper, just changing the scalar reality constraint amounts to changing H, right? So there is a redundancy here. There is a degeneracy. If you change your reality constraint, you're just moving on to another member of this family. So at the end of the day, there is no new direction in theory space to explore by changing the scalar constraint. So we can fix it once and for all. As long as we stay generic for the H function, we're still taking into account all possible theories in that sense. Then we can have a look at the tensor constraint. How could we generalize this? Well, as it turns out, this is just too rigid to be generalized. And there are some intuitive reasons to it. So if you remember these here, these 10 reality conditions could be understood as the reality of the underlying four metric of the theory. And here, if you look again at this four metric, and in particular, just the conformal class of them, then actually this admits can arise as the solution to this equation, which serves as the definition of this matrix, of these metrics. And as you see, you can therefore define this metric as the one with respect to which the B forms are self-dual. And you can also see that this is invariant under conformal transformations. So this equation indeed only determines the conformal class of metrics. So now, since this definition is unique, this is a unique metric, there is no other metric like that. So this shows why it's too rigid to be deformed. Actually, we have also tried to deform it. So use this definition here and generalize to a more general function of it, and it turns out that it doesn't work. So that is a nice result. At least the most intuitive generalizations of this constraint do not actually generalize the theories at all. So this is good. We have set this this liberty once and for all, and we can now focus on all the different H functions. Very good. So as I said, the scalar constraint is not unique, but we can fix it once and for all. And therefore the choice of scalar constraint, well, is going to be one of convenience. Here, we chose this one. So if you remember in the case of GR, it was just that here we had delta ij. And here we just generalize this by the internal metric, right? So this hij, if you remember, is this. And with the upper indices, well, it's just the inverse matrix. So this really plays again, acts again as a three metric. So these are going to be our constraints, and we are going to implement them at the action level, meaning that now our action is going to be made of the purely holomorphic sector. This is just the complex deformed theory action. And we're going to add to it another term, which is going to be made of the reality constraints. So this is purely holomorphic, right? And this here is real. So it contains both B and its conjugate B bar. And here you see that these chi fields are just the Lagrange multipliers that impose the reality constraints. Okay, so this is a simple setup, but I want to stress, in a sense, I really want to emphasize the structure of the action, the fact that it's it's not a real action, right? This here, this combination does not make S real. This is purely holomorphic. This is real, but we do not include the anti-holomorphic sector. And this is important because we have a nice property with this structure. It's that the conjugate fields only enter through the constraint, and therefore Taylor equations of motion impose that the Lagrange multipliers are zero on shell. Okay, so this is a nice property. And in particular, what it does is that this piece that we have added will not alter the equations of motion of the holomorphic theory. So by doing things this way, what we have is that we still have the equations of motion of the holomorphic theory, the complex theory, and the effect of adding this term is just to select, you know, the ones obeying the reality conditions, but we do not modify the equations of motion. So it's a very pure way of imposing constraints. Very good. And now before I proceed, let me also quickly justify why this choice of scalar constraint is very convenient. Well, it's because then the action can become even simpler. Instead of having this structure here, then the whole action can be written like this. You have the holomorphic part again here. You have the part that imposes the tensor constraint. And now instead of having the scalar constraint, it just translates into the fact that this phi field is real. Okay, so we have turned one of our nonlinear constraints into a linear constraint, just make one of the fields real, right? So this is a simpler way to formulate things. Very good, so this is all I had to say about these theories in this 4D covariant formulation. And now, of course, well, we need to check whether these reality constraints are compatible with the dynamics, right? Whether we are selecting a non-trivial subset of solutions of the complex theory, or whether we are just over-constraining the theory. And in order to do so, the best arena for this, to check the compatibility, is the canonical formulation. So we go ahead and split space-time in time and space. And here I'm going to be using, Greek letters from the beginning of the alphabet for the spatial coordinates. And what we can do is to define these E fields here, right, in terms of the psi matrix and of the magnetic field, so the, you know, the spatial part of the curvature. And of course, this E here is not by chance. These are going to be the conjugate fields to the spin connection. Okay, and also I want you just to see here that with this definition, now we have that we can invert this matrix here. And therefore we have that now this psi matrix is just this simple combination of phase space variables. So very good. What does, we have a canonical action. What does it look like? So here first I have written the part that corresponds to the holomorphic theory, right? Just the complex part before we impose any reality constraints. So here you see this is really the typical form for these theories given the gauge symmetries. We have the canonical term, so this is the electric fields conjugate to the connection. Then here we have the Gauss constraint. Then here we have the diffeomorphism constraint, so this would be the shift vector. And here we have the Hamiltonian constraint, so that this is interpreted as the Laplace function. And you see that the Hamiltonian constraint is really the function H that we had in the beginning in the 4D formulation. And since psi is a function of E and B, then this here is a function of E and B, and this is the Hamiltonian constraint. So from the original form, we had directly at hand the Hamiltonian constraint entering in that H function. Very good. So this is the complex theory, and now we're gonna see how the reality constraints enter here. So of course we have an extra term in the action. If you remember, we had this, this corresponds to this tensor constraint. And now it imposes simply the reality of some three metric, okay? So it's actually a three metric density that you can see here. And for those who are familiar with the GR case where this three metric density is just EE, well, here it's the natural generalization. Instead of contracting with delta AJ, we contract with the dynamical internal metric. So now in particular, this Q will depend both on E and on B, right? Because this psi is made of both of these fields. So of course, these are now, you know, this is like the reality of the three metric, which is part of the reality of the four metric that we imposed before. So we have, these are six conditions. We have now four more conditions, and these are the reality of N, which was like the reality of this phi field, and the reality of the shift vector, which is to be expected because now in the real theory, it's the real diffeomorphism group that is the local symmetry. Very good. So let's proceed and see what we can do about these constraints and how they are, whether they are preserved with the time evolution. So first of all, we first look at this, the ones of the holomorphic theory, right? The pure complex theory. And of course, given the symmetries of the complex theory, these form a first class algebra under the Poisson bracket. And what's interesting again here is that, you know, the self-commutator of H is it's what closes the hypersurface deformation algebra. And in this subcommutator of H, there is a three metric that is that pops up and therefore corresponds to the right the three metric that is privileged by the action itself. And this three metric is again this one here. So we see that we have a nice consistent geometrical picture, right? Of that there is really a unique three metric that appears in all the right places one would expect it. Very good. Now this is the case for the holomorphic part, but what happens of course with this extra constraint that is the reality of the three metric, right? This is the crucial question. And in order to answer that, well, we have to evolve that constraint and see whether it's preserved automatically by the dynamics or whether it is not. So in order to do this, of course, in the general case, so for a general H function, it's a mess. It's pretty complicated and we were not able to find some nice closed form equations, at least not some equations that would be easy to interpret or to enlighten us. So instead, we focused our attention to this very small subset of theories, which is given by the following Hamiltonian constraint. So here you see that we take the most general linear combination of all the possible triple products between E and B. And by triple product here, I mean this combination. So you can see it's just like a generalization of the determinant. If all three matrices here are the same, then this is the determinant. So this, for instance, is the determinant of E. This is the determinant of B. And you have all the other possible cases. And of course, once you determine what H is, then this automatically determines what the three metric of the theory is. And you see again that it's the most simple linear combination of all the possible double products, right? So you see that you have the EE, which is what we have in GR, but you also have the EB and BB terms. And now the coefficients that are in front, well, they're related to the parameters of the action in this nice, simple way. Okay, very good. So what can one say about these theories? So the first thing that would be directly visible for people familiar with complex GR is that this is just a natural extension, at least the most natural extension one could think of the Ashtekar formulation of GR. So indeed here, these two terms correspond to GR, and these are the extra terms that we add here that beg in a sense to be added, right? And so we have in a sense a two parameter extension of GR. In the case of GR, this would play the role of the cosmological constant and this would play the role of the Planck mass. Another very interesting fact about these theories is that they admit a geometrical interpretation. This is a very nice work by Kirill, and in fact, one can obtain them from seven-dimensional theories of three form with very simple actions by compactifying over a three-dimensional manifold. And actually, okay, what one obtains is not directly, I mean, this form here, you can see it in the Lagrangian formulation, let's say, when H is a function of psi. But anyway, just so you know that these theories are not just natural from this viewpoint, the canonical viewpoint, they also have some nice geometrical interpretations. And finally, let me also mention that here there is a redundancy, actually, because these set of theories is preserved, this form is preserved by this canonical transformation. So one can shift the electric fields by a constant times the magnetic fields. And this will just rearrange these terms here. So one can, instead of doing this shift, one can just, you know, redefine the parameters, meaning that at the end, only one combination of these two new parameters is really physical. And in fact, the best way to capture this, you know, this extra coupling is by looking at one that is invariant under this redefinition. And this will be this combination here. Okay, so now you can just think of these theories as a one parameter extension that is controlled by this delta parameter. Very good. Now that we have shown these the theories we're going to be working with, we can proceed and have some explicit equations to work with. So okay, so we start by computing the time derivative of the three metric, right? So here, before I was working with the inverse three metric density, but here is going to be just the corresponding three metric. It's not a big difference. So if we compute the time derivative, here you see that, of course, because of the diffeomorphism invariants, the time derivative will always arise with a lead derivative with respect to the shift. Anyway, this is the evolution operator. So the evolution of the three metric is given by some expression involving, the E field, B field, and derivatives. And all this, by definition, is what one would call the extrinsic curvature. So, of course, since this is a second order theory in time derivatives, all the juice is in the evolution equation of the extrinsic curvature. And here you have it. And this is essentially the novel and most difficult result to obtain in this work. It's essentially what you obtain is this very simple few terms on the other side of this equation. And what is very interesting is that the first four terms are exactly the same as in GR. So those who are familiar with the 3+1 formulation of GR, this would be the so-called standard ADM form. And so we have GR plus some extra terms here, okay? And so this is, just so that we're clear, this is the Ricci tensor of the three metric. These are covariant derivatives acting on the Laplace function. And let's see who the newcomers are. So here we have this V, which is this combination of V and B. This here is the determinant of the three metric. And we have this tensor of the rank 3, which is also a combination of E and B, right? This is just E times B here. Okay, very well. And we see that this here is controlled by the extension parameter, this delta. So this is very nice. So we have obtained GR plus some extra terms. And what is even nicer is to re-express all these equations in a 4D covariant form, okay? So here, of course, I focused on the evolution equations, but as you know, you also have the constraint equations, so Hamiltonian and momentum constraints. And these equations also have some extra terms. So we can put all the extra terms on the right-hand side and express them in a covariant language. And this will just look like, the Einstein equations. So G mu nu equal T mu nu, where now we have an effective source. We have some effective T mu nu on the right-hand side. And this effective T mu nu is very interesting. It takes this very simple form. So really here, one can almost directly recognize that this is just the T mu nu, the energy momentum tensor of a minimally coupled set of scalars, right? So if you interpret these psi matrices are scalars with internal indices, they have some internal metric, which is Hij, and they have some potential. And just to make things clearer, this is really, if you wanted to derive this energy momentum tensor from an action, this would really be that action. So a minimally coupled scalar field that is of course coupled to the connection, since it has internal indices, it has the internal metric and some potential. So this is, I just put it in a box here because I find it really, really pretty, but I think it's a non-trivial result that we obtain such a simple equation of motion, right? I don't see why it should be a minimally coupled combination. Anyway, so now that we understood the geometrodynamics, this is of the complex theory. Now we can see what happens with the reality conditions, right? Because now it's everything is explicit and transparent. So let's go to this. So we want to impose the reality of the three metric. And of course, this leads directly to the reality of the extrinsic curvature. And then we have to check whether the extrinsic curvature is also real. And I rewrite here the equation just to make it clear. Well, this term is real if k is real, this term is two. This term is real if the three metric is real. And this is the case for these two. And of course, this is the case for GR, right? So GR, here we can see why the reality conditions are compatible, because the evolution of k is consistently real. And here, unfortunately, the extra terms are not real, right? That's the problem. The problem is that neither V nor S can be expressed in terms of K or Q. So by making Q and K real, we don't make this effective source real, which means that unfortunately the reality constraints are not conserved, right? Now, of course, we could look at it the other way around and say, well, okay, I mean, this is what happens. This is the standard situation, right? You compute the evolution of constraints and then you impose whatever you find, you impose it to be a constraint as well. So what would happen if we impose this effective source to be also real? Well, then the problem is that we would neutralize all the degrees of freedom of the theory, right? Because we already know that for GR, imposing these two to be real already reduces the degrees of freedom down to the minimum of two, right? The massless graviton. If we go ahead and impose even more tensor constraints, then we are killing these degrees of freedom too. So at the end, if we impose this, the only solutions are ADS, de Sitter and anti de Sitter. Very good. So this is a bit of a bummer. I mean, there were arguments of why these theories don't work, right? As Kirill mentioned before, but this is a very explicit way of checking this, and also fully nonlinearly. But then again, we can still ask ourselves, what are the cases that actually work, right? Until now, I told you that, you know, this extension controlled by delta is an extension of GR. So then if I set delta to zero, then a priori one would think this is GR. But actually there is more to it. There are two theories. One of them is GR and the other is not GR. And it also has conserved reality conditions. So that is interesting to see what is this other theory. So let's set delta to zero. Now, it's pretty straightforward to show that if you do so, then V, this potential here, then becomes constant. So then you don't have this term that was problematic because it's complex. And now this term turns into a cosmological constant term, right? So you're back at GR. You have really the evolution equations of GR. So, but of course I told you right just before that this is not necessarily GR, which might sound weird, but let's see how this happens. So, of course, if we do this, we obtain the closed, as I just said, GR geometry dynamics, and also the same GR constraints. So the constraint equations are also going to be GR. So how can this not be only GR? So yeah, and here I just want to mention that the reality conditions are going to be conserved if you pick this constant in V to be real. So let's see what is this other theory, okay, which is not GR, but which looks incredibly like GR. So if we set this to zero, we have to understand what does this mean, right? So I told you before, this delta was this combination of parameters. And actually this combination is not any combination. It's the discriminant of the three metric. If you look at the metric as a quadratic form, then this is the combination of the parameters that tells you whether the metric is an exact square or not, right? So if delta is zero, this means that I can write the metric as E plus B squared, right? And if we can write the metric as E plus B squared, essentially, then we can use this E redefinition to obtain two distinct forms. So what are the exact square metrics? One possibility is that it's just the square of E, right? And in this case, H is like that, and this is GR. But the other possibility is that Q is the square of B, right? Which would be like really the dual of GR. GR is just the electric fields, and this is just the pure magnetic fields. And this is consistent. There is no problem in working with the theory that has a pure magnetic three metric. What is interesting is that the corresponding H function is really closely related to the one of GR. So GR is the trace of the psi matrix, and this one is the trace of the inverse matrix. So it's really like the sister of GR, and it actually already has a name. It has already been studied as a theory. It's called self-dual GR. And if you want more details, you can look at this paper here. So you can describe it with a very nice action. It's the so the complex theory is just this. It's essentially psi now acts as a Lagrange multiplier imposing that phi I phi j is zero. And then if you add the reality constraints, you also have that phi I phi bar j is zero. So essentially this theory imposes way too many constraints on the connection. And the result is that the connection is so overconstrained that it can only be de Sitter or anti-de Sitter. And the extra degrees of freedom that we have, right, are hiding in this psi field here. So this theory has the same number of degrees of freedom as GR. It preserves the reality constraints. So the reality constraints can be imposed in a compatible way, in a consistent way. But the degrees of freedom are not in the connection anymore. They are in this extra field, which is always entering linearly the action. And because of this, these degrees of freedom have an unbound energy. So this is not a physical theory, unfortunately, but it's a theory that has the that works in given the criteria that we put before. Okay, so that's for the interesting bit. And now let me just give some arguments for answering this question for the generic theory. So we have seen that, you know, there is this obstruction to reality conditions. What can we is there some more hints we can take out of this specific case to understand the generic theory? So I think what is really nice here is to realize that this tensor that was obstructing the reality of the three metric can be re-expressed in our theories as essentially the self-commutator of the metric. So if you take the Poisson bracket of the three metric with itself, you obtain exactly this tensor. What is interesting here is that this is not zero, right? This is counterintuitive when we come from GR. And it's not zero, of course, because Q depends on both E and B. So there is no reason why a priori the Poisson bracket with itself would be zero. And this now can be, you know, you can take this hint and consider the most general theory, in which case the three metric would look something like that. So it would take again the same form as before. You would have an EE term, EB term, BB term, only now the coefficients in front would not be constant. They would be functions of psi. So this would be the most general three metric you get out of E and B. And of course, this thing will, in general, will not commute with itself under the Poisson bracket. So we see that there is a relationship between the fact that these metrics cannot be real and they cannot commute with themselves. That's an interesting point. And it actually explains why this doesn't work in our specific case. And it kind of hints at why this should not work in general. So if you do not commute with yourself, then you cannot be a canonical variable, right? You cannot be a coordinate in phase space, because then by definition, you would be commuting, it would be self-commuting. And then if this cannot be the case, then of course, you cannot obtain a canonical three-metric formulation. You cannot, as in GR, right? Where you can just work directly with a three-metric and the extrinsic curvature. And if this is not possible, then of course you will not obtain closed geometry dynamic equations as in GR, which then guarantee that the reality conditions work. And this is why you should not expect the reality conditions to work. So I think this is pretty interesting, right? It really shows it really reveals that these theories are essentially non-metric in nature, right? They are not. They, in the sense that these metrics cannot be consistently made real, and this being related to the fact that they cannot commute with themselves. And I find even more interesting the fact that, you know, if you then go on and quantize, then this becomes really the commutator between the operators. And then it's interesting to see that this, for these theories, a non-zero commutator would mean that, you know, there is an uncertainty between different components of the metric, right? So this non-commutativity is not non-commutative geometry, but I mean, it would deserve the same name. It's not the same, but it's in taste or in conceptually, at least it's close. And I found this interesting, right? So very good. This is essentially what I had to say. These would be here now my takeaway messages. I think it's important to know that these deformations of GR exist, and that in the cases of Euclidean and split signature, they're working perfectly fine. This is, I think these are important points. the Lorentzian signature is unfortunately doesn't work. So it requires this non-linear reality conditions. So it's non-trivial to impose them, and they're generically not compatible with the dynamics. So unfortunately, there are no non-trivial deformed Lorentzian theories. But nevertheless, you know, if you forget about the part that is about the reality conditions, there is also this analysis of the geometrodynamics of these theories, which is interesting. For instance, for the Euclidean and split signature cases, it could allow us to understand a bit better how the underlying geometry works, and how this is different from GR. So that's it. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Armis, for this very nice talk.
Thank you.
Okay, so are there questions from students first? Okay, for now, I don't see any question from students. So next is Bianca.
Yeah, thanks, Emrys, for this very interesting talk.
Thank you.
You had this remarks in the end about the non-commutativity of the spatial matrix.
Mm-hmm.
And well, that this then doesn't allow geometric dynamics. So interestingly, in after quantization and Lupin gravity, our spatial matrix in some sense does become non-commutative, which actually gives also reason that the simplicity constraints become anomalous to a certain extent. Actually, become anomalous, and the anomaly parameter is exactly the Barbero-Mirzi parameter.
Okay, but in the context of GR, you mean?
So the difference is that classically it's commuting, so it's really an effect which you can see comes either by quantization or by discretization.
Okay.
It really comes after you replace, after you decide to quantize the what in our case are E fields. I'm not quite sure they're the same as your E fields. By angular momentum operators.
Okay.
Compactify the connection to SU2. So it's this kind of curvature which leads to non-commutativity, not directly of the spatial three metric components, because that you would have to reconstruct, but it's really that the three metric.
Okay.
Quantities
this is in
are
the-
non-commutative.
This is in the real a real formulation context.
It's, it's in the real formulation context. Yeah,
where the amazing parameter comes up. Okay,
but it leads to a kind of a similar effect, namely that actually the simplicity constraints get in some get second class.
I see.
So which are kind of reality conditions. So similarly, in some sense, the reality conditions become. And they are now, I mean, I think we described it very recently in much clearer form, but originally then in the models, they are kind of weakly imposed. So it's also a question to Kirill, because at some point, Kirill, if I remember correctly, he had a model where the simplicity constraints were replaced by a potential. So are these models which you have here related to that?
No, so these models where you replace them by a potential is this trick of Kirill where you you redefine the B field. I don't think this is what is happening here. So here it really you start with really the Lorentzian, so covariant, you know, complex. So you don't have the Mirzi is I, essentially. You're not exploring the parameter space of, you know, the real theories with the tricks with the Mirzi. You're really in the complex and you're generalizing the GR case. So I think it's different directions in the space. Then, okay, you can have similar effects, But the GR case, the GR limit in our here would be that there is the metric self-commutes with itself. Uh-huh. You would not have the emergency, any of the emergency problems, because the emergency is just high. So it's when everything works pretty fine, right?
Uh-huh. Maybe it's not completely obvious to me that this is completely different. What Bianca is saying is that if you have a metric, of course you start from a different perspective, but at the end of the day, you have you make a duality rotation of your metric between the E and B. And this is exactly what the emergency parameter is doing. So I would not go so fast as saying that these are an equivalent, because you know, making a gamma rotation is just changing the way you kind of slice your metric too.
Yeah, is B A?
I mean, introducing an emergency parameter is a way to do a duality rotation in the space of E B field. So, like, yeah.
What is really different here is that there is no anti-holomorphic sector. In every real theory, you can rewrite it as holomorphic, anti-holomorphic, right, and mixed terms. In this context, it's the holomorphic mixed terms, but no anti-holomorphic sector.
Yeah. No, that part is different, but when you look at the real metric, if you look at the mixing of E and B, which is interesting, is very similar, you know, maybe it's different, but it's kind of similar to, you know, what happened when you change duality frames, which is kind of, which of course in loop quantum gravity we see only because of boundary effects, etc. So for different reasons, but at the end of the day, there's some similarity.
We see it in the very definition of the model. Yeah, so it's to emphasize that this looks very much similar to what happens in loop quantum gravity, and it could enlighten, you know, the problem there.
But again, in loop quantum gravity, it's a quantum effect. This does not.
Yeah, that's true. That here, yeah, it's completely classical.
Yeah.
I would say.
But it's also, you could maybe see it as an effect which really comes from the canonical transformation, which introduces the Arshtika variable. So. You know, then it depends, because that gives you a connection which you can then exponentiate, and that leads to the problem. Mm-hmm. So it depends on which step you see as the problematic one, the one which allows you to do the problematic one, or the actual problematic one. I don't know.
I must say myself, I don't have expertise actually in. Quantum gravity, so I don't want to say I'm not sure about, but for this part, yeah, I think as Kirill said, it's really something already at the classical level, and we're really working only with exclusively with the self dual. We don't mix the two representations. It's just one. It's the pure self dual complex where, you know, and this is what you get. So the mixing here really comes from a different, from the deformation. This is the parameters that control this non-commutativity are the ones from the deformation.
Mm-hmm.
In the GR case is really everything works. It's Ashtakar, essentially, the complex. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that helps with respect to.
Well, I mean, there's a thing that when people say it's quantum, this mixing, in fact, is really due to discretization. It's not really a quantum effect. And it is due to the fact, and this discretization, when you introduce the emergency parameter, what you're doing is that instead of working with the E field, we work with a field which is E alpha E plus beta B. Okay, so that when you square that field, which is the natural variable in, so, you know, it's completely classical, in fact. It's just that the discretization effects are different in different variables, right? So here, it looks like in the metric you have in your slide, well, not all the metrics, but there are certain metrics that can be reabsorbed into just redefining what you mean by the E field, right? So if you define a new E field, which is alpha E plus beta B, then maybe your metric looks like the square of the new E field. And then, so anyway, that effect, this rotation of the E field, which is a change of canonical variable on your phase space, it's part of, let's say, what people explore. I'm not saying it's the same, but
I see. So in that case, if it has to do with mixing E and B, then yes, I mean it's of the same kind of thing. But you see here, if if I can bring my Q to EE by just redefining, by just shifting, rotating E, as you said, then this commutator would still be zero. This commutator is controlled by this delta. So even if you have E and B in your metric, they enter as a total square, then the commutator will still be zero. So it's invariant under the canonical transformation by definition.
And this is where the discretization effect. So at the continuum level, this is true. But now when you discretize, you make small error. And this is what Bianca is talking about. And suddenly, well, it is zero, but then, you know, it's not because of that mixing. So it's very hard to keep it in a regularized, right?
So indeed, this mixing for it to be zero, I mean, it's a non-trivial when you also have E and P, but just in a... So and then if you discretize, I guess maybe you get anomalies.
Maybe to move on and ask another question, which is, does it mean it's completely dead, this direction? Or can you, for instance, choose parameters so that the non-conservation of the reality condition is small?
So indeed, that's the big question, right? Is there a theory that works? So first, the fact that the natural extension doesn't work is already okay. But maybe there is a crazy H function that works. I think this is why it's crucial to reformulate the things in terms of this non-commutativity, because at the end of the day, you need it to commute with itself for it to be able to be a canonical variable and therefore have closed geometry dynamics, right? So if I had to explore for this crazy H function, I would try to look to solve this equation, set this to zero and find which are the functions that work. But in general, there won't be. I won't expect them to have a solution, to have a non-trivial solution, right? Because the thing is that, first of all, these functions here have to be related by a consistency relation because they all come from a single H function. And second, you see that the structure is, I mean, already with our extension, we have captured the generic structure of this three metric, right? It's like these three independent tensors. And then, you know, what you can generalize is just the scalar factors in front of them. So I don't see how, if there is an obstruction between the commutation of these tensors, how just changing the multiplicative constants in front of them will make this commute. So I would be very surprised if there exists a theory that is not GR and for which the reality conditions work. Because honestly, I expect the general case, I mean, not to commute with itself. I don't know what you think about it. Maybe it's worth, it's a well-posed mathematical question, right? Find the theory for which this is zero. But I don't.
Okay. And maybe interpretational, what does it mean if exactly the Lorentz case does not have such an extension, but the Euclidean one?
It's very weird, right? My personal understanding is just that it all comes from the structures of the groups, right? It just turns out that the Euclidean and split signature group split into, you know, the direct product of two real groups, and the case for SO13. This is where all the complication comes from. It's just the structure of the groups. Then, of course, there are many other interpretations, but this is how my way of understanding it. So it's just we're unlucky to be in the, you know, among the three choices to be the group that has the most complicated structure.
Okay, thanks.
Yes, so there is another question by Seth.
Okay, hi, Aris. Hello. Thank you for the nice talk. I just wanted to go in the same direction like Bianca was going. So that, can I say that it means that the Lorentzian gravity model, it's unique from GR, Lorentzian GR is unique, and then it cannot be extended by choosing some function of H of psi? Can one say that?
Well, I guess, yeah, I didn't write it down. I didn't make a claim, because to make a claim, you have to explore really thoroughly, and which I haven't done, right? But yeah, indeed, at the end, what I expect, that the weaker claim is generically none of these theories work. So you would expect GR to be unique with a Lorentzian signature. It is, if you want, an extension of the uniqueness theorem. But, you know, I just cannot make that claim because I haven't proven it mathematically to the end. But at least this shows, I think, that's why it's very interesting, the structure and doing the geometrodynamics and really focusing on these, is that you get a good taste, right? A transparent viewpoint on why you should not expect it to work.
I see. Yeah. Okay, thanks.
But sorry if I cannot be more...
it's okay.
Okay, so there is another question in the chat by Nosrat. Nosrat, do you want to unmute yourself and ask the question?
Yes. Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for your nice talk. Maybe my question is not so professional, it's elementary. I saw some papers that have ascribed some curvature to the Hamiltonian, like in Pinsler geometry. In the momentum space. Is there any relation between these theories and those?
I'm sorry, I'm not aware of them, so I cannot answer your question, unfortunately.
Well, I think he's asking the question. In a sense, the answer is yes, because as Remis described, the Hamiltonian function here becomes modified. It becomes function of this psi Lagrange multipliers. And psi Lagrange multipliers themselves can be expressed in terms of the curvature FF. So there is a viewpoint of these theories that what you do, you make the Hamiltonian to be curvature dependent. However, this happens in a way that does not increase the order of field equations, which is crucial, and doesn't change the degrees of freedom. So this is very, very strange, right? If you do it in the usual formalism, if you decide that your Hamiltonian is a more complicated function of the curvature, or if you modify Einstein Hilbert deduction, right, to make more complicated functions of the curvature, you increase order of field equations. So this is a very strange modification in which you do allow your Hamiltonian or action to become a non-trivial function of the curvature, but order of field equations doesn't change, and the count of degrees of freedom doesn't change.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Are there more questions or comments? I think I also have a small question. I think I didn't fully understand your answer to Bianca and Seth. So how much these results are general, if you want, because in at least from what I have understood, you started from a very specific type of action, the Plebinsky action. So it is not clear to me that these results would extend if you change the symmetry group or if you add more terms in the Lagrangian according to a different symmetry or a restricted symmetry.
So you would say maybe we could explore by altering the complex action?
Yes, I mean, the same methods, so complexified actions and search for reality conditions, but for different theories. And in that, by different theories, I mean, you can extend it in different directions if you want. If you have different symmetries, for instance, or if for a given symmetry, you add more terms in the action in terms of higher derivatives that, however, are still compatible with the symmetry that you are choosing.
Mm-hmm. No, well, then absolutely. I mean, it's, the statements I made here are about this particular class of theories, right? So then, of course, if you want to consider more general, you can go ahead. Now, the thing is, what is really, remarkable about these theories is that they preserve the degrees of freedom. Now, I'm not sure. Of course, maybe then you can come up with even more general modifications that preserve the degrees of freedom, but I'm not aware of any. So, and this is already a pretty big parameter space, right? Mm-hmm. So indeed, the statement I made, I mean, it's not, that's why I cannot, again, say a statement about uniqueness of GR. It's not a theorem. Maybe there is other things one can do, but about this class of theories, which which is already well, you know, studied and identified, that's it. I think it doesn't work. Of course, then if you want to go beyond, then I cannot say anything about that. But who knows? I don't know. I don't know if Kirill is also aware of even more modifications that preserve the degrees of freedom. Because that's the thing, you need to, if you add degrees of freedom, then you have to find a way of removing them too, right? The point is to obtain a theory that only propagates a single massless graviton. That's not trivial, right? So
one simple answer is that if you change the gauge group but leave the same class of theories, it's clear that one is adding degrees of freedom. One can actually calculate the number of degrees of freedom, and it does change. So you can modify in that sense by enlarging the gauge group, but you're considering completely different class of theories. So it can be done, but why would one do this?
Okay, thanks. Are there more questions or comments? Okay, so if not, let's thank Hermes again for his very nice talk and the discussion. And please unmute yourself and let's thank Hermes.
Thank you very much.